The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information, go to KUCI.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram.
And good morning and welcome to this December 18th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us on Stitcher. However you consume your podcasts, we are under Writers on Writing. And we are still inviting your thoughts because we're getting so many great thoughts. If you've been a longtime listener or you're even a brand new listener and want to give us some feedback about the show, we'd love to hear it. You can email Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net. You can email me at mariestone, M-A-R-R-I-E, @gmail.com. Just let us know your thoughts, what you want to hear more of, what you want to hear less of, what you like, what you don't like. All that stuff is really great feedback. Based on some of that feedback is how I organized the show this morning. So I am your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. So one of your thoughts was including authors across genres, which I really haven't done a lot of. So today, not only did I find well-known authors from two different genres, but I found the fathers of those genres. Louis L'Amour, who was really well-known in the Western and Frontier genres, continues his legacy through his son, Beau L'Amour, who has revived a lot of his lost manuscripts and has put together a couple of volumes of his father's collection. He's a writer in his own right. And he's a screenwriter. And we have a really interesting discussion this morning planned for you. And Robin Cook began the medical thriller genre with the book you may remember, Coma, back in the 1970s. That was sort of my first adult fiction book when I was a kid. So he has written, you know, over 30 New York Times bestsellers. So he is on as well. First up is Beau L'Amour. Louis L'Amour was the 20th century's foremost storyteller of the American West. He wrote 91 novels, a book of poetry, and over 200 short stories. There are more than 300 million copies of his books in print around the world. In addition to Western novels, he called them frontier stories. He also wrote work in the adventure, crime, historical fiction, and science fiction genres. Louis passed away in 1988 at the age of 80, but since that time, his son, Beau L'Amour, has made it his life's passion and work as manager of Louis' estate to revitalize his work and bring back some of his lost treasures to readers. Beau L'Amour is a writer, art director, and editor. He has written and produced several films, including USA Network's The Diamond of Giroux. In the years since his father passed, Beau has helped sell over 120 million books, nearly 5 million audio programs, and placed a number of books of short stories out of 16 posthumous collections on the bestseller list. Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures Volume 2 came out last month. It's published by Bantam, where all of Louis' work was published. And it's my pleasure to welcome him on this morning. Beau, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming on. So we could talk for 30 years about your dad's work and his legacy and your own work. And fortunately, I want to do a little plug here. If our listeners are interested, there's a wonderful website on your dad, louislamour.com, and you've got a wonderful website. And then you and your sister have done some really great Facebook Live shows about the Lost Treasure series, which are all up on YouTube. So if for people who want to check out more, there's plenty available for them to do that. So I just wanted to make that little plug there. But, given we only have 30 minutes, I'd love to sort of kind of distill the best nuggets your father left behind and you have gathered for writers about craft and process and what you learned for him, what you learned for yourself. I'd love to know, he was so prolific and so beloved. And I was wondering if you had ideas, now that you've sat with his work for years and years, sort of what set him apart and what made him, 30 plus years after his death, still such a part of the collective American imagination. what made him different from other writers in his genre and of his time, do you think?
I think actually he was a lot like a lot of writers of his time. There was a lot of really, really fun literature that was written, you know, as popular literature in the paperback original days from, you know, say 1950 to the early 90s. But I think the thing that really sets Dad apart was writing for him was just a joy.
Yeah.
And he had created a way of working, which we can talk about, which made it that way. But I very much believe that the energy that goes into writing any kind of work is the energy that the audience also takes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And his energy was happy and energetic, and he loved doing what he was doing. And I think people, you know, just turn each page getting a tiny little subconscious sense of that enthusiasm.
It does strike me that he wrote almost as much for, yeah, as you say, kind of almost as much for himself as he was writing for the reader. And he wanted to be just as surprised as the reader was. So he, you know, he was also writing towards a sense of discovery as opposed to, I thought of this story, I've kind of mapped it out, I'm going to tell it to you. He just seemed just as curious as the reader to find out what was going to happen next.
Yeah, and you feel him. I hope you feel him. I mean, it's been years since I've been able to read him this way, just because, you know, once you're the mechanic, you approach things very differently.
Yeah.
But I think the reader can really feel his that sense of exploring the story, and I wonder what's going to happen, and they feel like they're, I don't know. I come from Southern California. I always put it, it's sort of like surfing. It's like you're being carried along just by the oncoming lip of the wave. And that's the feeling that you have when you read him.
I love that. Was he, would you say, very much, it felt like very much story-driven, plot-driven, as opposed to character-driven, that it started always with story for him? Would you say that's true or not?
I would say not, sort of. I don't know. Those are terms that it might be better to talk to someone else about, because I don't, personally, my own approach to things is that the plot only happens because you have the right characters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so disassociating the two of them is extremely difficult.
I got you.
Disassociating theme is a little easier, but if you or anyone else was to read No Traveler Returns, this recent novel that was my dad's first and was unpublished, which I finished a couple of years ago, that story is very long on character and very long on theme and very delicately woven together, and it's not very long on plot. And I think, you know, he, after writing a number of short stories also in that same vein, they're wonderful stories, but they weren't satisfying something I think his audience, his growing audience wanted more than anything else, and he was alerted to that fact, and he got a little more serious about stories being, you know, more about the plot, moving them forward.
Right, right. Tell me a little bit about your decision to take on this, I know it's an act of love, but to take on kind of excavating a lot of the work that he didn't have the opportunity to publish when he was alive, and finishing this project. Like, you know, kind of what was the, was that always going to be your plan even before he passed, or sort of walk us through kind of that decision-making process?
No, it wasn't always the plan. I think, you know, one of the things, I'm also a writer. I've done a bunch of research. I've spent some time, you know, researching my dad, because there was a lot that was kind of mysterious about him, a lot of things I had to discover about his life. And after visiting quite a few libraries and historical societies and looking through people's so-called papers and things, I became kind of irritated with the attitude of a lot of academic institutions, in that they kind of keep this material locked up, you know, just for special people like themselves. And, you know, we've been approached by a number of organizations that wanted Louis's papers, and I was always kind of cautious about that. And I, at a certain point, I started thinking, well, it, you know, why not make these things for everyone? Why not? It might take a little interpretation, which is something that I'm doing in the Lost Treasures books. But why not just put this stuff out there for the public and create some manner of packaging it with the books that help people understand what his life was like.
I love that. We should take a little bit of time for people who haven't picked up either of the Lost Treasures volumes. And there's an additional volume of material out there. The name is suddenly escaping me as I'm sitting here, but there's another book of material as well. And for people who haven't picked it up, I guess it makes sense to kind of talk about what's in here, your comments and author notes, and you know what people.
Why don't I
get.
Do just a quick description of it all?
Yeah, exactly.
So we have. I think the first thing for people to understand is I've gone back into around 30 of Dad's old novels that were, you know, published and classics even before he passed away. And I have created a bonus features postscript to those books, telling you sort of the story behind the story. So that might be the story of how Louis did research for a particular book. It might be how he was inspired to write a particular novel. You know, if there was someone behind that, I'm thinking most particularly here about Kiowa Trail, which was actually rather specifically written for Katharine Hepburn. Mm-hmm. Was there an interesting story behind the making of the movie? Whatever I know that's the background of that book, I will put into that postscript. Following that, there are these two books of new material, Louis Moore's Lost Treasures, Volumes 1 and 2, and those are, for the most part, not completely, but for the most part, unfinished works, but they're unfinished works that Dad left a lot of additional materials about. And so using those additional materials, I kind of dive into the mystery of what was this story going to become, how did it fit into his career, what did he intend to do with it, not just as a creative writer, but as a businessman. And so those books also really kind of explore the process of being a writer in the mid-20th century and the trials and tribulations that he went through. And then the last piece is a novel, Dad's first novel, which I already mentioned, No Traveler Returns. And this was unfinished, and so I went in and finished it and polished it and turned it into, you know, the sort of work that he was intending to create when he first wrote it.
I love that there's a little bit of detective work on your part where you were pulling out some of his old typewriters to try to, you know, carbon date when he was writing these novels based on what typewriter they were written on.
Yeah, no, there actually was quite a bit of research that went into this.
Yeah, yeah. So talk a little bit about that. You know, there's strikes me as several levels here of, you know, trying to get the voice right, matching the voice, trying to get into his head, trying to get into the story's head, which are, you know, kind of two different things, I think.
Yes.
Keeping up the research, all of that. Like, you sit down, you see a piece of unfinished work, and kind of, can you walk us through that process a little bit of accessing voice, story? That's a big question.
Okay, so kind of the how it's done.
Yeah, yeah.
Part.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of things. I was trained to be a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, I studied acting quite a bit. And, you know, so one of the things that you work to do is, of course, get the voice of the character.
Right.
And so finding that character in bits of evidence is something that I had already practiced quite a bit.
Okay.
And then in the early days, I've actually been doing this sort of work, the mending of broken documents and the creating of a more perfect short story for some time. I wrote pieces of many unfinished stories back in the 90s and early 2000s. And it's not too terribly difficult when you depart from the original writer's material and then you reattach to it some paragraphs or pages later. You know, you have a trajectory stylistically as well as everything else from the end of the piece where you leave the original writer's words, and then you have to fill in something, and then you attach to the beginning of the next section that you're using.
Right. Yeah.
And that makes it easier. Of course, after doing that more and more, I kind of got to the point where Dad had about maybe five different, at least to me, distinctive styles in his life. Mm-hmm. And I can do four of them pretty good. There's one, the last iteration of Louis L'Amour, like Louis L'Amour 5.0, that I'm not so great at. And I don't really try to go in and ever mess with that style because I know I can't do it well.
Hmm.
But I'll do that. I also, if I'm going to work on something, I do a lot of research about where Louis was at the time, what he was thinking about. Of course, I have all of his correspondence. I have all of his journals. I have access to everything I would ever need to do this. And, many times if I will be fixing a story and I have to take something out, maybe I take out a little more than I'm comfortable with, I will try and put back in things from his life. So not only am I trying to match the style, but I'm actually putting in sometimes more Louis L'Amour than Louis put there. That just comes from a lot of research. I remember a boxing oriented kind of crime story that he was doing, and he had never, it took place in Portland, but he had never mentioned this in his story, but I use one of the locations is Wiley Spivey's gym and pool hall. This is a place where my dad worked out when he lived in Portland.
But
he never used it in the story, but I was sort of like, well, Louis was writing it. It takes place in Portland. Let's throw in some actual details from Dad's life and for added verisimilitude.
That's so great. It's a wonderful way to keep your relationship with him going years after he's gone. I mean, this sort of mind meld, keeping him alive, not just for his readers, but for yourself, I think is a really cool, cool thing.
Yeah, can I say wonderful, strange, and sometimes disorienting?
Yeah, right. I can imagine
little,
it would be. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little odd. I mean, he really hasn't departed. That is so wonderful. But sometimes, not in any major way, but sometimes in very slight ways, I find myself, not entirely present to the world as it is.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and maybe that's a good thing these days. I don't know.
<it's>... I think it can be a good thing at many times, but it's kind of like it's like, how many years has Dad been gone? Oh my God.
Yeah, right.
That's so strange. It feels like only yesterday.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, it strikes me as a writer that it would be very nice to have so many jumping off places, that he did some of the front end work about here's an idea and you take it and run. But then as you're talking about it, that mind meld that you have to get from the back end strikes me as tricky. And when you said that you can't access Louis 5.0, that last iteration of him, mm-hmm. I almost wonder if that's like an age thing, that as you approach the age he was, if that will become more accessible to you, or if that was a style that just is independent of age and experience and just something that you can't access.
I also think it's a style that I personally am not as happy with. I'm when I look at my dad's life, Louis 3.0 or 4.0 was really kind of the apex of what I like. And it may very well be that last style, if he had lived a few more years, would have kind of coalesced in better ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the earlier styles had, and he was definitely trying something else when he was in the you know, the Series 5. He was definitely trying something different. And, you know, my take on it at this moment is it wasn't quite working 100% yet, but that's only my own taste. I mean, other people love it. So it's that's not so important. It's all, another thing that's appropriate to say here is I don't and I won't just manufacture Louis L'Amour stories for public consumption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I might change this little rule, but at the moment, my feeling is that I only finish things that he started, and I only finish things that he started where he left a pretty good vision of the entire trajectory. And so I'm doing the best job. I know I'm doing a job that's close to what he intended. On a couple of occasions, I have been accused of making up stuff and writing books that actually Louis wrote. I mean, there are fans, and sometimes when they don't like a book, like one that was written 5 years before I was born,
uh-huh.
they say, "Oh, that's something that Bo put together." And you know, I wouldn't have published Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures, Volumes 1 and 2, a great deal of unfinished material,
right.
if I was the person who was out there, you know, kind of creating posthumous material just for the money.
Right.
I wouldn't have done that. I have saved all that stuff and capitalized on it over the next few years. But those were things that, with one or two exceptions, I knew that I probably wasn't going to take on and finish.
Right. Right. The other wonderful thing about this book is it's got, it's got a lot of photographs, but it's also got photocopies of his notes. So you can kind
right.
of see how he would sketch a story out enough to give you something to jump off from. And I think it's a really interesting, as you're talking about, I kind of had to know enough about where he was going to feel confident enough to take the work on. And oftentimes it sounded like he didn't know exactly where he was going. He had an idea, but he also wanted to open up the possibility of surprise. And that too allows you to have your, you know, the kind of the mind meld of, you know, we can kind of take this leap together and figure out what's going to happen next. But I guess there was enough material there for you to at least know what his general idea was or where he wanted it to go.
I don't improvise as good as my dad did. And this is something, you know, for your audience, this is something that's really appropriate to discuss here. While I was, while I was working in theater and film and things like this, I learned a little bit about improv comedy troupes. Okay, so these are people who just basically riff off of one another and the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend, interestingly, she's Carl Marlantis, the man who wrote Matterhorn. She's his daughter. And she was in a terrific improv group in Los Angeles. And one of the things that I learned from her and from hanging around with those people a little bit was kind of how they worked. And this process is constantly kind of almost in using sort of hypnotic using the kind of techniques that a hypnotist almost would use, opening yourself up to the process so that there is no barrier between your creative impulse and allowing it out. And this is very difficult to drop that particular drawbridge. And once you get it dropped, it takes constant work to leave it down. And my dad worked very, very much like this. He was really scared to not write every day. And it was because the constant act of opening that door up and letting the creative material out is like a muscle. And if you don't do it, it becomes harder and harder and harder. And in my life, having constantly done creative things that are then followed by extremely technical execution of that thing. Maybe it's a movie, or I did a graphic novel a few years ago. I did a lot of dramatized audios, things like this, where I'd do the script, and then there was the process of very technically executing this thing. And oh my God, it's like pulling teeth to get the creative side back up and running after you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the reasons for his intense focus on writing all the time wasn't only that he needed to be super productive, it was that he was afraid of losing it.
This is so useful because two things are striking me as you're talking about this. The first is that he was very open to taking all sorts of risks and not, it seems like, and not self-critiquing along the way, which allowed this,
right.
You know, Louis 5.0, and it allowed him to write science fiction in addition to Western fiction, in addition to nonfiction, in addition to poetry, without cutting himself off too early and saying, I'm not a poet or I'm not a nonfiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
And what a gift that is. And then another point you made, I think, in one of these great podcast or YouTube seminars, was that writer's block is not a matter of a creativity block. It's a matter of a confidence block. And
you can always go back and fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this,
you know,
idea of the drawbridge, I just love it. I love that idea of keeping the drawbridge down. And the only way to keep it down is through time, you know, holding it down by writing every day. That's wonderful.
You have, and the defensive metaphor is apt, because there is something in you that is protecting itself by not having that open.
Yes. Yes. That's interesting. Do you have any other insights or techniques on, in addition to just writing every day, on ways you have managed to keep your drawbridge down?
I do practice self-hypnotism.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm not as good as I used to be, but I used to be incredibly good at putting myself in trance. That may help some. It's certainly kind of a weird experience.
One of these stories was written, one of your dad's stories in here was, maybe it was written in more of a dream state, but you also called it a trance state.
That's right.
Yeah, that's interesting. So maybe, like, if you can't get yourself into that state, you almost wake up very early in the morning when you're still in that kind of sleep state and your inner editor hasn't quite woken up yet. You haven't had your coffee and you can maybe access that dream state.
I'm not so good at that, but my dad was very adamant about being at the typewriter by 6:30 or so.
Great, yeah.
And he always liked to get a couple of pages out before breakfast.
Yeah. The typewriter would wake you up, though. It's so loud.
It was the story of our lives. That was the
the soundtrack of your childhood.
It was definitely the soundtrack of my childhood. And Dad had a very, very particular typewriter. He had a very early, maybe even almost the first electric typewriter. It was an IBM Model B. And not only did it clack very loudly when you hit the keys, but it really rumbled. There was a rotating drum inside it that was used to power the keystrokes.
Uh-huh.
And that thing would just kind of grumble like an idling engine. And so, yeah, that sound is very, very familiar to me.
And I love that he just wrote a bunch of first or, you know, one or two chapters of a book, set those chapters aside, started working on something else so that you would have sort of this idea thread sitting there waiting for you if you wanted to come back and work on it. But it sounded like he had several projects going at one time.
I'm not sure that there were several projects going, you know, literally to the point of being finished and perfected, but generally when if he was working on something and he had another idea, and I find that happens quite a bit. And I always keep a notebook right alongside my word processor, because I'll get new ideas as I'm working on something, and it's almost like some creepy part of your muse trying to pull you away and distract you. And I just jot the ideas down really quickly. But he would take a couple of hours off and write, you know, 2 pages to 2 chapters and to feel like he had a starting point, the place where he would be inspired to go on from.
That's
and, of course, that left behind all this fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's really did you feel like he was kind of your active teacher in a direct way when he was alive, you know, that you knew you were going to be a screenwriter, an actor, and he was giving you tips, or was this kind of absorbed by osmosis?
I don't even know that there was all that much osmosis. I wanted to do it. You know, I grew up in Los Angeles. It's sort of like if you grow up in Detroit, at some point or another, you end up working in the car business. So I kind of wanted to work in film. I wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do. I didn't really intend to be a writer, but then to kind of have access to the sort of things I wanted to work on and things like that, I had to write. I found I was kind of good at it. And luckily, I was able to get in and audit acting classes. I did some acting, but mostly I was just auditing with a wonderful acting teacher, Janet Elhante, for about 20 years. And so, whenever I needed a tune-up, I would drift back into her class. And, I wanted to be a screenwriter. I would put it this way. I was trying to learn what my customers needed. So my customers, in this case, were actors. What did they need to perform a good scene? And at the same time I was doing that, I was also producing these dramatized audio programs like old-time radio drama to a slight extent, hopefully a little more up-to-date than that. And, you know, when you take a scene in and you see 60 actors read it cold and 45 of them seem like they don't know what they're doing, that's not them, that's you. And when 45 or 50 of them pretty much get the main points of the scene and perform it well, then that's you. You know,
right.
It's sort of like you can control a performance by writing the scene correctly. And and so those two things, the acting and the working through auditions with scripts, really, really taught me a lot.
So interesting. I love this. I have to throw in this little piece of trivia that I thought was great, that your father didn't drive and Ray Bradbury didn't drive. So they'd sort of, I don't know how this happened, but they'd kind of meet up on the street or something walking around L.A.
They would just run into each other, but they liked the same places. They would go to Hunter's Books a lot, and they had some coffee shops that they would end up at. And so, they would, and that was, it's not so much any longer. I don't see people like this around on the street or in places in Los Angeles. But when I was writing my first audio drama, I probably wrote 5 scenes on 5 different nights sitting at the counter in the Hamburger Hamlet in Westwood Village.
Oh, yeah.
1, 2, or 3 stools away from Neil Simon, who was doing the same thing.
Great.
And so anyway, Dad and Ray would run into one another, and then they would stroll talking about whatever it was. I also think they were both very prolific writers because they didn't drive. They didn't have that distraction.
Right. And pre-cell phone, pre-internet, you could get a lot more done. Yeah, right. It kills me we're drawing down on our time, but is there other advice that we didn't get to that you think should be out there for writers and creatives?
Yes, write your first draft as fast as you possibly can, and don't care whether or not it's sloppy or it doesn't get everything done. It's sort of like get your butt in the seat, get your fingers on the keys, and write till you get to the end, and don't show it to anybody until it's good. But it can be as bad as you want, but boy, that first draft is so much harder than anything after that.
Yeah, it's December now, but it sounds like you'd be a big proponent of NaNoWriMo, of just, getting the November draft out there, to write a novel in a month and worry about all the word smithing later.
And I'm terrible at that.
Yeah,
but I know it works. I mean, I know ultimately I have to force myself to just get in there. And, you know, I will, when I see something I don't like and it needs fixing, I'm sort of like, I need to go back and fix that. And I can hardly stop myself, or many times I can't stop myself, but I know it's better. Keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. So that must be what he did. And then,
He
was putting out 3 books a year. So the revision process also had to be pretty fast.
He didn't really revise things when he got done with it. So what you see in the Lost Treasures volumes 1 and 2 are a lot of revision at the beginning and him figuring out how to get started. But once he got past page 40 or 50, there wasn't much in the way of looking back.
Incredible. Incredible. Beau Lemoore, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
This was great. That was Beau Lemoore. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Dr. Robin Cook is the author of more than 35 novels, perhaps most famously Coma back in 1977. With that book, he became the pioneer of the medical thriller genre and now explores the perils of the medical field, when well-intentioned technological advancements can go bad, the consequences of treating medicine as a business. He spins out ideas of where we're headed with technology and what's coming. He's got a body of 37 thought experiments that are highly entertaining, educational, philosophical, and fairly chilling. His latest is Genesis. It's published by Putnam. It is out and available as of December 3rd. And we are going to spend the next bit of time picking his brain. Dr. Robin Cook, welcome.
Thank you. Nice
Thanks
to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So I have to tell you that Coma came out when I was 6. I didn't read it when I was 6, but I do have this really vivid memory of it being the first adult book that I snuck off my parents' shelves when I was probably like 9 or 10. And it scared the crap out of me. The cover alone scared the crap out of me. But I always say that I sort of lost my adult book virginity to that, my adult novel virginity to that. Do you have any memories like that as a kid, like the book that sort of was your gateway drug to literature?
I wish that I did, but I don't. My introduction to literature was Stuart Little.
Oh, that's a good one. That's much more sensitive.
And in
than
fact, when I was in the third grade, that's when I read Stuart Little, and I didn't like the ending. So I rewrote Stuart Little, and so that was the beginning of my writing career, I guess.
That's fantastic. So now it's 35 books later. I think there have been 37 books in total, and your ideas just keep coming. I keep waiting for an idea, but I'd love before we dive in, I love the Stuart Little comment, and I would also love to hear your... you obviously started out as a doctor, and I'd just love to hear that genesis of how you decided, you know, when you were in medical school, that as if that weren't enough, that you were going to layer over the top of this, becoming a novelist as well.
It was stepwise, but it was when I first got to medical school, I could tell that the environment was not what I expected. As soon as I decided I wanted to be a doctor, you entered this very competitive environment, because it seemed that when I was in college, just about everybody in my class wanted to be a doctor. And so it was very highly competitive. And what I thought is, all right, it's very competitive, and I'm going to compete, et cetera. But once I get into medical school, then we'll be able to really just concentrate on being a doctor. Well, that wasn't the case. And as soon as I got into medical school, the first lecture we had, it wasn't even a lecture. It was sort of a welcoming talk by the dean, who then told us that 5 or 6 of us were going to be invited to stay after medical school. Which, what that did is that it just inculcated that the competition was just as bad in medical school as it was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And it never stopped. The competition goes all the way through your training. Well, back then, even the surgical residencies were pyramidal, so that each year they winnowed you down, so you were always competing against each other. But the problem is that medicine is actually a team sport, and yet we training doctors the absolutely wrong way. That doesn't encourage people to work together. And so I started to realize that why is it like this? And then I realized that that medicine was losing its sort of direction. Instead of taking care of people, it was becoming a business. Mm-hmm. And this has progressed since I was in medical school to the point of what it's like today. It's the biggest business in the country. It's the most lucrative business, and that's the major goal is business. And so that's what stimulated me very early on in medical school. I said, you know, someday I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book the way medicine really is, not the way people want to think it is, and include the way that the training is done. It's not conducive to the kind of personalities that we'd like in doctors. And but of course, I didn't have any chance to write a book as a medical student. You can't be any busier. Especially, I worked at night while I was a medical student all the way through medical school, and then I was a surgical resident. I was even busier. And it wasn't until I got drafted, and during the early part of the Vietnam situation, I was drafted, and it was when I was in the military the first time I had free time. And so I said to myself, all right, I have some free time. And I said I was going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. And so I wrote a book. And that's how it began.
I love it. I love it. And you're right. You know, things have gotten so much progressively worse that, you know, I kind of think if you were in any other country writing these books, if it would work as well. I mean, the United States is such a unique animal in the way that we treat medicine and the way we treat the sick. And our opioid epidemics and on, you know, that it's the perfect sort of crucible for the writing you do. I mean, we seem like the most extreme example.
Yes, that is true. And that's why when I first started writing, I got some requests to publish my books in other countries. And I thought, well, they're really mostly going to make sense here. But how wrong was I? Because actually today I sell more books overseas than I do here.
Great. Great.
And medicine is an issue and a problem all over the world. Even though we have the worst system, we are the ones that are leading medical inflation. And medical inflation now is infecting the entire world because of what the United States is doing. Mm. And It's not quite isolated here. What we're doing here, unfortunately, has a big effect, even though all the other industrialized nations really make an effort to take care of their people.
Yeah. Normally, I'd say we couldn't be living through a better time for these novels because technology and, you know, sort of the singularity is near and we're taking off exponentially. In all sorts of realms, but you know, it's an exciting time to be writing in this field, I would think, because the ideas are just generative. I mean, you're just never going to run out of something to talk about.
You're correct. I mean, there's just huge things that are happening all the time. Last year's book, it was called Pandemic. It's about CRISPR-Cas9 with this new gene editing technique. And which is really relatively new, but it really works extremely well, and so that was the subject matter of last year's book.
Yeah, 2 years from now, you could write that book again, and the you know, the way that it has spun out will be, you know, exponential. Like I say, it's just every month there's something coming out that's even more interesting and exciting in that field. Well, let's dive into this one. So introduce Genesis and the genesis of the idea and kind of take us into this novel.
Mm-hmm. What really stimulated me on this one was hearing about the fact that the Golden State Killer, you know, from your state, was captured after being on the lam for some 30 years, I think, or something of that sort, after having thumbed his nose at the police and the law enforcement for so many years and raping and murdering so many people. And then suddenly in 2018, he was apprehended. And how was he apprehended? He was apprehended by using ancestral DNA. And I was somewhat aware of ancestral DNA because it was, you know, you saw it in the news, et cetera, and you saw advertisements for it, et cetera. I personally wasn't interested because I am a total mongrel, and so I don't really care knowing how much of this and that and the other thing I am. And I also had no thought that I might possibly be related to the Romanoffs or other royalty, so I haven't been interested. But that made me really interested, not to do it myself necessarily, but interested in the field, and interested in the field that it was really becoming a true addition to forensics. And I've been interested in forensics because I've written probably almost a dozen, or if not a dozen, books about this medical examiner couple,
right,
Jack and Lori. And so I realized that here was another subject that the general public should know something about, and I should know something about,
right,
more than I did. And so I researched it, and I always go overboard in my research. And the more I researched, the more fascinated I became with it, and the more sure that it was a good subject for one of my books, and that the general public, my readers, would also enjoy it. And so that was the origin.
Can you give us like a little preview of what your opinion is after all of this research? Of, you know, you said that you wouldn't run out and do it mostly because you're not interested, but do you think it's sort of a bad idea to give up your privacy in this way?
Well, you know, you take risk whenever you do anything like this, but I think the risk is pretty small because I think the companies are recognize that aspect of it.
Yeah.
But it's also not going to be used specifically by the law enforcement because there's no chain of custody. You know, in other words, you send in your sample, the company doesn't really know it's your sample. It could be somebody else's sample.
Yeah.
So there's no chain of custody, so it can't be used. That's why when they thought they knew who the Golden State Killer was, they needed his DNA. And how did they get it? As I understand it, they got it just by following him around until he went into a Starbucks and got a cup of coffee and then
right,
got rid of the cup, and they got the cup, and there's DNA all over it. We, of course, are shedding our DNA all the time, so it's not like we can keep that a secret. And the positive aspects of what knowledge of DNA and ability to test DNA, the positive aspects of that so far, to me, overwhelm the potential negative effects. It's eventually going to revolutionize medicine and pharmacology. We'll be treating. We're going to be prescribing drugs according to your DNA profile at some point, because that way you know whether or not the drug is going to be effective or not.
Right.
And so
it's so funny, right?
But it doesn't mean that there isn't some concern. And you know, we're all a little bit worried about 1984. And government supervision and watching what's going on in China makes us even more worried.
Right. Yeah, no kidding. It's funny, right before we went on the air, I just read this snippet in a magazine about companies that are now, they're calling themselves Heritage Concierge. They're travel companies that take your DNA results from these ancestry websites, and they customize trips for you abroad, you know, to follow your ancestral heritage, to meet your distant cousins. You can travel with a photographer that will document all of this for you. You'll go through all of your old villages. Trips start at $250,000, so you can Anyway, I just thought this was funny. This heritage concierge, I was like, man, this DNA ancestry stuff is permeating every single business out there, including the travel business. So,
wow, that is fascinating.
Yeah.
That is fascinating.
I should say you can do it.
Well, it just shows it. I mean, there's real interest in it. There's definite interest.
Yeah. No kidding. And so this book, we have a new character. We've had the Emmy, Dr. Lori Montgomery, as you said. She's been kind of a recurring character. How long has she been around? Quite a while.
Yeah, I think she was in my book, Blindsight, first.
Okay.
When was that? I'd have to look at my...
12 or 13. She's been around for
over a dozen
books, probably. Yeah.
Yes. And but now she's actually the chief medical examiner.
Right.
So
right.
There's a new level, and which is interesting because you find out by reading my book of why it's so difficult to be a chief medical examiner.
Yes.
I mean, you know, the medical examiner has to be independent. If the medical examiner is not independent, in other words, if the police can tell the medical examiner what you're going to find on this case, then it's all for naught.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be independent of the police, and they have to be independent also of politics. So they have to be independent of the mayor's office, and yet they're chosen by the mayor, and can be fired by the mayor. So how can that work? It's really a tightrope walk, and also. Like the New York City Medical Examiner's Office is $75 million a year, and if that's not renewed each year, every year they look at it, you know, the city council looks at it and whatnot. So constantly, it's a constant tightrope walk, and I have a bit of fun with that in the book.
And it's playing itself out in our own politics every day. You can watch all these conflicts play out all over the place, and you get to explore it here too. That's great. And this new character, her protege, Aria Nichols. It was fun to see new people come in too. It's great.
Very interesting character.
Yeah. So I would love to switch over to the writing process itself for our writing listeners here, and kind of walk us through sort of idea inception. I know you're a big outliner, and I would really love to kind of dig into exactly what these outlines tend to look like, how deep you tend to go, knowing that, you know, your idea has enough legs to carry it through the novel, sustaining suspense, all of these kinds of nuts and bolts things. We know where this idea generated from, and it sounds like you knew really early on that it had enough legs to carry you. So then what happens?
Then you have to make a story. And a story has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, that sounds so simplistic, but it's so true. A lot of people don't really have a story sense, and because they confuse a story with like an episode or some cool thing that happens or something, but that's not a story. A story has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, as I said, and so developing a story sense, do you know where I developed my story sense from, I believe, in retrospect? There was a man in California, his name was Carl Barks, and he was the one responsible for doing these Disney comic books of Donald Duck. And when I was young, these Donald Duck comic books were fabulous. They were actual stories. They were, with a beginning, middle, and end. And I loved them, at a very young age, and I still have them. And I kind of every so often I go back and look at one or read one and look at the pictures again and remember. I think that's what gave me a sense of a story.
That's great.
So
is it
so
like
first
the...
is the
Go ahead.
First, it's the it's the issue, and this issue was the using this ancestral DNA or genetic DNA in a way that in forensics. And all right, so how was I going to do that? How would I involve Jack and Lori in a way that would make it interesting? And how can, you know, in terms of a mystery and a thriller, you have to have a little bit of both. And how do you maintain that? So I build the concept from the basic part, but start to think of what kind of a character would make the story happen. Rather than having characters being dragged along by a series of coincidences, I like to have the character actually make the story happen. For instance, in Genesis, Aria, who is the young woman, her particular personality, her past, the fact that she was abused by her father and abused by a boyfriend in college, etc., she really doesn't like men. And she doesn't even like forensic pathology. She doesn't like being where she is. She has to be there for a month, and she really doesn't like it. She much preferred to be doing real pathology, as she considered it, back in the hospital. But she has to be there, and so she doesn't get along with everybody. In fact, she gets along with very few people. But one of the cases that she's subjected to is this case that starts the book. There's a young woman who the title, Genesis, where does that come from? It comes from the fact that there's a fertilization. So there's a young child, a very, very, you know, young child, embryo.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a young woman, and the young woman, you have a feeling that, uh-oh, I think something happened to her. And the next thing you know, she's on the autopsy table. And so they're doing the autopsy, and they find, unexpected, that the woman was pregnant. And this evokes in our character a sense of outrage. Why was this woman not found? Why was she allowed to rot in her apartment for 3 days? Where's the boyfriend who conceived this child? And did he supply the drugs for her overdose? Those are the questions that go through her mind. And so she decides, we got to find this guy. We don't know. We can't say that this was an accident until we know more about how this woman died. And so that's actually the way the story begins. And it begins because of, she wouldn't have done that if she didn't have her past. And she's really decides that she's going to do this, no matter how difficult it is. And there doesn't seem to be any way of getting it to happen until someone suggests using genetic DNA.
Right, yeah.
And that's interesting, too, because they don't have the DNA of the perpetrator like they did with the Golden State Killer.
Right.
They only have the DNA of this embryo, but then they also have the DNA of the mother. And what they can do is subtract the mother's DNA from the embryo's DNA, and the DNA, the 50% of DNA that's left, is all father.
Yeah.
So they have half the father's DNA.
Yeah.
And then there's some interesting statistical methods that can enhance making the other half, or figuring out what the other half is. And a lot of this has been developed by people who have been conceived by sperm, and the sperm donation was supposed to be anonymous, but they still want to find the father because they have, maybe they want to know their their background in case they have some sort of medical problem that is genetically associated. So this has been there's mechanisms that have been developed to do this, and which even that's sort of interesting because most men who've donated their sperm expected anonymity. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't have done it.
Right, right.
So anyway, that's how it starts and how the book starts, and then the story is how this woman actually uses this, learns all about it and uses it. But even that's not a story yet.
Right.
There's gotta be more to it.
Right.
And something very strange happens to this main character. But I can't tell because that would be a spoiler.
Right. No, you can't tell us. But tell me how long is your outline? Is it like 100 pages? Is it kind of mimicking the book chapter by chapter, or are you just kind of sketching out, here's an idea?
Yes. Yes and no. I did it a little bit different for this one. I do my outline on very large sheets of paper, and it's done down the center of these very large pieces of paper in the minute handwriting. As an ophthalmologist, I put my entire medical school in a little loose leaf book that I could put in my pocket.
Great.
Because I could write so small.
Great.
And I do that. And the reason I do that down in the center is because, and I do it chapter by chapter, but I have all the sides of these big pieces of paper to kind of make an arrow. If I want to move a whole scene, I just put a square around the scene and put the arrow down and put the arrow into where the scene would be better down here.
Great.
And,
okay.
I can do this on these big sheets.
And then do you have a line for plot and then lines for characters? Because your characters kind of have to have their own arc and backstory. Or is it all in that same line?
No, it's all in the same line. But I do biographies of all the characters to begin with.
Okay.
I'll do a whole biography. And sort of relate it to the story, but I do a biography, because I really want the characters and their personalities to make the story happen.
Yeah.
Because to me, that's what I enjoy the most. I enjoy not only writing it, but I enjoy reading it if it's in another book. I like that better.
Yeah.
Character making the story happen.
Right. And for these characters, like, you know, the medical examiner, she's been around so long that you've really got to keep track of what's happened to her.
Yes.
Readers love to catch writers in, conundrums, right?
They do indeed, and I have been caught on a couple of little things. But I do make an effort, and with each book I then modify my biography of that character,
right?
A recurrent character, yeah.
Everything that, yeah, she's been through and what she's... I also love how you're able to sort of, you know, sneak in some, if you were a parent, you'd sneak in the vegetables inside of the dessert, you know, to us by educating us a little bit about, you know, the medical examiner's son has autism and this ridiculous anti-vax thing that we're all living through right now. You're able to kind of let people kind of educate us a little bit, give a little bit of public policy, social commentary while you're entertaining us. And I really love that.
That's the benefit of fiction, because especially if you've created a recurrent character that people like, and because then you can manipulate your reader to some degree because they like the character. So they're going to naturally fall in line with the character's point of view. And so I use that mechanism. In Genesis, for instance, Jack is the husband, he's kind of a loose cannon to some degree as well. He's tasked with going to the school because the school is upset that their boy, their three-year-old boy, he's in the third grade, is acting out, he's getting into fights in the playground, they think he has attention deficit disorder. That's a knee-jerk reaction with elementary school people, and it's part, my feeling is part of the fact that we're over-treating boys just because they have a Y chromosome.
Yes.
And I think boys tend to be a bit more rambunctious. You know, back when we sort of evolved, they had to get out of the cave and fight a mammoth. And so Jack knows he's knowledgeable enough to know that he's not really good to go to the school because he's going to be mad, and he doesn't want the kid told that he's attention. He doesn't want the kid put on drugs.
Right.
So there's an example of what you were talking about, is to incorporate that into the book. It's not part of the main story, but it becomes sort of part of the main story.
And in a culture now that, you know, we're being self-referential so much that, you know, we're living in our own information bubbles and we're only taking in the information that we want, it kind of strikes me that fiction is a way to reach across the bubble aisle, you know, that the articles that we're going to necessarily read are just preaching to the choir of people who already, you know, are not anti-vaxxers
exactly.
or whatever. So, yeah, so this is a really nice way to say, hey, you over there that might not agree with me, I'm going to introduce you to
absolutely.
This other idea. Yeah, that's great. That's
absolutely. Great. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's why I think fiction is more powerful than nonfiction.
Yeah.
And there's been examples in the past. Harriet Beecher's Uncle Tom's Cabin was a good example of that.
Right, right.
And so is, what was the book about the immigrants in Chicago and the meatpacking?
Upton Sinclair.
Yeah.
The Jungle. Yeah, The Jungle, right.
The Jungle, right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah, they snuck in a lot of social commentary there.
Yes. Well, it was interesting because that was what he was really after, was social commentary of how we were treating immigrants. And yet the book became classic in terms of the formation of the FDA.
Yeah,
and
right.
Laws against, you know.
Any last-minute advice you have for writers? We'll end on that note.
You have to find discipline. That's the biggest problem, I think, with writing. It requires using more of your brain than anything else, and that's why you get so tired and why you think of so many other things you're going to have to do before you sit down. But you have to sit down.
Yeah. So hard. So hard and so necessary.
It is.
Yeah. Well, this was great. Thank you so, so much for taking the time. I really appreciate this.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Orion's Belt is coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.